I want to tell you my secret now. I see dead people.
Silent Green is people!
Need my sister and my daughter!
Rosebud. What's in the box?
Hello and welcome to another Slate spoiler special. I'm Marissa Martinelli, an assistant editor here at Slate, and today we're spoiling Crazy Rich Asians, a romantic comedy based on the novel by Kevin Kwan, itself loosely based on Kwan's own childhood in Singapore. Directed by John M. Chu, Crazy Rich Asians marks the first major Hollywood movie since The Joy Luck Club, which came out in 1993, that is centered around the Asian American experience. Here to talk with me about the film is Slate staff writer Ingu Kang. Hello, Ingu.
Hi, Marissa.
And making her spoiler special debut is Shasha Leonard, who writes Slate's IT column, Try Restarting. Welcome to the Slate spoiler special, Shasha.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We are here today to talk about Crazy Rich Asians. I have waited so long to say that. How much hype has there been for this movie?
So much hype. So much hype, and it lived up to it, in my opinion. Just throwing it out there.
What about you, Ingu? Your review was a rave. You like this movie, too.
I love this movie, yes. But yes, the hype machine is really on steroids, to mix metaphors.
Well, there was a lot of pressure on the movie, too, that comes with the hype, in that, you know, much like we've seen with other movies starring minority casts, this had to be the movie as like a tester for Hollywood. Is it going to succeed or fail? And it's actually done really, really well. It had a great opening weekend at the box office. It's gotten hit reviews. And we are going to talk about all of that. Has anyone read the book Crazy Rich Asians?
So I have not.
Okay. I have not either.
Okay.
I've read all three books.
Wow. Okay. Wait, how did you come to find those books? Because I read that it was an easy, sleazy beach read, and I generally avoid those reads. Yeah.
So there's a blogger by the name of Lainey Gossip, who is actually Elaine Louie. She's a celebrity blogger who is actually very smart about sort of deconstructing celebrity narratives. And she does this sort of weird ad hoc book club. And I think a lot of her recommendations are quite good. And because she's a Chinese-Canadian writer herself, she tends to provide a lot of recommendations that are books about women and people of color. So this happened to be one of them. And I thought, you know, she's talked about this book 10 times. Why don't I just give it a try? And then there went all of my free time.
It's always hard when you have a book that is this popular to turn into a movie, because you know you're going to anger the fans. Did you think they did a good job, Ingu? I mean, we can go into detail a little bit more about the plot, but what did you think as a fan of the book? How did this compare?
I would say that in some ways, the book, at least from an Asian American perspective, from my perspective, I thought the adaptation was really great, because it really brought, the book is very encyclopedic, and the book is very into the fine-tuned details of Singaporean wealth on like a sociological basis. But I wouldn't necessarily say that the book is moving. And I think that the film is moving. In the Culture Gabfest for this week, I said that the books have Singapore, essentially, or the Singaporean aristocracy as its main character. Singapore is just the most interesting thing about those books. And in the movie, Rachel, our main character, the Asian American economics professor who goes to Singapore for the first time and encounters all of this and is our viewpoint character, she's the most interesting person in the movie. And I think that that translation or that adaptation was a really necessary process.
And she's played in the movie by Constance Wu, who I was only familiar with her from Fresh Off the Boat prior to this. But she is such a movie star. I mean, she has such a screen presence.
Yeah, and she's an excellent actress.
I know. This cast was amazing overall. I mean, we have Constance Wu as Rachel, who, like you said, Ingu is our main character, who is Asian American. She is dating Nick Young, played by Henry Golding, who came out of nowhere. He's a television presenter. This is his first real like acting gig, and is also extraordinarily handsome. Like, it hurts to look at him for too long. We also have Michelle Yeoh as Eleanor Young, Nick's mother, who is not entirely approving of his American girlfriend. And also in the cast, we have scene stealer Awkwafina.
That wig was everything.
The Ellen wig.
I almost didn't recognize her for a second. And then I heard her talk and I was like, oh, it's Awkwafina.
The accent gives Awkwafina away. She's having such a big year. I mean, she had Ocean's 8. She was a scene stealer in that, too. Good year for Awkwafina.
Yeah.
And tons of, this is an amazing cast of like every prominent Asian American actor that they could fit into the movie. And it, if anything, it made me like so aware of how like seldom we see these actors all on screen at the same time. Like a lot of these actors have been the only Asian cast member on a particular show.
Yeah, yeah.
Or one of, you know, a couple.
And Hollywood likes to say like, oh, we're happy to cast more Asian characters. It's just that there is not a wealth of characters or actors to pick from. I think this movie completely defies that, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, if you need a palette, here it is.
All right, so let's talk about the movie. Let's start with the opening scene, which was not what I was expecting. Ingu, I think I skimmed the first couple pages of the book, so it seems like it actually starts at the same place, but it actually starts in London in the 1980s with Michelle Yeoh and a young Nick trying to take up their reservation at this hotsy-totsy hotel and being turned away by a racist clerk.
Yeah, maybe you'll have more luck in Chinatown.
What a line.
Dude, the whole theater I was in, we were all just like, ooh.
Yeah, my theater was the same way.
Gasp. Actually, something wasn't clear. I haven't read the book, so I don't know. Does she at that moment call her husband to buy the hotel, or is she already the owner of the hotel and the staff does not know that?
No, I think she goes and buys it.
She just buys it.
Yes, which is more impressive if you think about it.
No, it's...
Because then the old decrepit owner comes downstairs and he's like, well, my reign as owner of this hotel has ended right now.
And he's jolly about it, too.
Must have been a really good offer.
Got a good deal. Yeah. And the negotiation made in a couple of minutes.
Mm. That was a very satisfying scene for me. And it really set the tone for Michelle Yeoh in this movie as just like a boss.
Yeah. She's got like a steel touch, but with such grace and like class and elegance, where she's like, you missed a spot over there, clean it up, you know? Woo.
Yeah. I mean, she's known for action movies. She's known for Hong Kong action movies. She's known for James Bond. I loved her on Star Trek Discovery, but she's very authoritative whenever she's on screen in the best possible way.
Yeah. Growing up, I think she and Lucy Liu are the only female, like, you know, in Hollywood movies that I grew up watching as role models and stuff like that. So it's interesting to see like this whole cast full of awesome ladies and men, which I would like to talk about the masculinity of these Asian men, but later.
The masculinity or their chest?
Why not both?
Their hyper masculinity. I think might have been the one thing that I didn't appreciate. I know what they were trying to do. They were trying to show that Asian men can be sexy. And of course they can. I just don't think that Asian men need to be swole to be sexy.
Mm. No, I think that's a good point. I mean, at this, so we started off with Nick as, you know, a little boy. Mm. He grows up to be.
Oh my God, what a cutie that actor was.
He really
too.
Was.
Yeah.
He grows up to be Henry Golding.
good job. Good job to him.
And he is dating Rachel Chu, who has no idea that he is actually from one of Singapore's wealthiest families.
Plot hole.
Going in from the trailers, we knew. And the movie's called Crazy Rich Asians. But I have to say that when he invites her to come with him to Singapore to go to the wedding, you get that great scene where someone is walking by a gossip blogger, basically. And we get to actually see physically with graphics the news travel all the way around the world.
Mm. And what I really loved about those graphics is that they were WeChat.
Oh, were they?
Yeah, I think so. Right, Ingu, did you pay? Did you pay attention? Like, I think Shirley, pointed out to me.
Hmm.
Yeah, those. It was deliberate. I don't know if it maybe it was a copyright thing, but they looked very similar to
right
the apps.
I didn't notice that for about half a second. Kevin Kwan, the author, is on screen.
Oh,
in the WeChat or whatever the chatting
Weibo's
network
also
spiderweb is. And in the credits, he's credited as texting author.
Appropriate. I love those kind of cameos. Yeah. They're so cheesy, but I didn't even notice. I don't think I actually know what Kevin Kwan actually looks like, but that's so fun. One thing about that sequence, I was under the impression that some time had passed because they show so many people sending this message. But sort of the joke is that when they cut back to the bar where they're sitting, literally no time, like from the space of the gossip blogger walking by to getting to the door, everyone in the entire world knows that Nick Young has a girlfriend and that he's bringing her, or a friend, quote friend, as they say throughout the movie, and that she is coming to the wedding.
Yes, and we should note that Nick is going to be the best man at this wedding, and the couple that is going to get married, Araminta and Colin, are so wealthy that essentially the entire island is abuzz with anticipation for this wedding. It's basically the royal wedding, mm-hmm. except complete with paparazzi. And I think that's important to note because it's a $40 million wedding. And of course, later the aunties are telling, like, that's too much. You shouldn't spend more than $20 million on a wedding, which is
everyone
sort of like
knows
a,
that.
Yeah.
Which is the level of wealth that we're dealing with right now.
So, yes, we know that this wedding is going to be enormous and very lavish. Rachel does not know. Rachel finds this out in the most hilarious possible way, which is that they board the plane to go to Singapore, and they're taken into this sort of suite. I don't know. I didn't even know
that was a thing.
I've never flown first class, but I've walked through first class with the rest of the plebes, just like, you know.
But that's not a first class I've ever seen.
It was like a cabin. There was a bed of some kind.
Yeah.
I mean,
it was closed off. It was a private suite on a plane.
And then Rachel's like, so your family's rich, right? And he's like, well,
we're comfortable.
Nicest, like nicer than, you know, most
people. Wearing silk PJs, yes, provided by the airline.
I love the sort of fantasy of this movie, that you get to kind of live in this world that is exclusive and that most of us don't get to experience. And I'm going to catch a lot of heat for comparing these movies, but a lot of the appeal of this movie aligned with what I love about the 50 Shades movies, although this was much more opulent. Just the wealth porn continuously throughout. It was superb.
Yeah, it's almost like looking into a different world, but not a world so unlike your own that you can't believe all of it. Except for the barge. That cannot be a thing.
I don't know. I thought that was not unbelievable to me. I love how, well, we'll get to the barge, but there is.
No, sorry. I meant like it's all believable because it's not a world.
There's no dragons.
No, exactly. It's all close enough to our reality and like the things that we've seen on, you know, TV and media and paparazzi that I can believe that this kind of wealth exists.
Mm-hmm.
And I still like, I can't look away. I'm disgusted, but I can't look away.
Were you? I was like, what's her name? Peek Lin, when she's invited to the party. And she's like, I couldn't possibly. I was like, go for it, girl.
She was like, yeah, I'm going.
So she lands in Singapore. They get to Singapore.
And I guess, like, they have that rendezvous with Colin and Araminta.
Oh, yeah, of course. The food market.
So, essentially, Nick and Rachel land in Singapore. And they are picked up at the airport by Colin and Araminta, who you were sort of, like, expecting these, like, very grand people. And they're just like very rumpled looking Asian people, surprisingly, which will like come back later. So anyway, they go to the, I believe it's like the famous street food scene in Singapore's Chinatown, actually. So then you get like this like vast montage of food porn.
Yeah, much like the wealth porn, the food porn was agonizing to watch.
Yeah, and it comes back many times during the film.
Oh, yes, that's hardly the only scene and you're where sitting my there stomach is rumbling.
And you're eating popcorn, like crappy popcorn, and you're like, please.
I will say that in my screening, I went to a screening with, I'd say, a majority Asian audience. And it was a press screening, but it was also open to some of the public. And the girl next to me had brought dumplings.
Yes.
And I was like, this is not fair, because I had the visual and the smell. They should serve real food at these screenings, because the food on screen is unbelievable.
I wonder if the Alamo will do something on it.
Oh, yeah. Alamo Draft House.
Mm-hmm. Because they serve food. Yeah. And they do specials sometimes, like they did for Deadpool and Isle of Dogs. Right.
I think so. Yeah. Not a bad idea. Little Brooklyn aside.
Yes.
I feel very prophetic right now, because a couple of years ago, I wrote a piece for MTV about how actually the perfect movie theater food is dumplings. And I feel like I really called it.
I would agree. As someone who had to sit there and smell them, I really wanted dumplings.
Because they're small, they're portable.
They are.
Yeah.
You don't have to use your hands.
You can get a nice variety, too. I mean, mm-hmm. every culture has sort of a version of the dumpling.
Yep.
Pierogies. Bring them all in. Now I'm really hungry and I forgot where we are.
Yeah, I'm distracted.
So they go to the street, the Chinatown
food market.
Street food market. Mm-hmm. And then, so essentially, in the next scene, more or less, Rachel and Nick wake up together in their hotel room, which is significant because Eleanor had made it fairly clear that she expected her son to stay with her and for Rachel to stay in a hotel. So we already have this set up where Rachel and Eleanor are going to square off at some point.
Yes, because he's deliberately choosing his girlfriend over his mother's wishes, which is a big no-no when you're a matriarch.
Yes, and we also get a sense of, with Rachel's impending arrival, a family dynamic with all of the aunts. They're reading the Bible, actually, when they hear the news. But when she finally comes, she's under a lot of scrutiny from the family. The aunts, and then, of course, Nick's grandmother, who essentially raised him. He grew up in her house, who is sort of the one to impress. I mean, the mom's important, but the grandmother, it's implied, is sort of the make or break.
Yeah. And the reason for that is that the grandmother is quite old, and it's a question of who is going to inherit the family inheritance. And so, again, it's implied that if Nick's grandmother disapproves of his future wife, then she will disown him and the family fortune will go elsewhere.
We should note, too, that she's actually Nick's father's mother. Michelle Yeoh's character has married into this family, which is significant, not least because we never see Nick's father. He's always
on a business trip.
Yep.
Working.
I thought that was going to lead to something like some kind of secret or a big plot twist, or he was going to show up at a pivotal moment, but he just never arrived.
Did he have was he a character in the books, Ingu?
Yes, he was, but he occupies a very, very similar role in that the story is largely about Rachel locking horns with Nick's mom. And I mean, this is sort of getting into the weeds of it, but a lot of the third book is sort of about how the pressures of Singaporean society, especially in their milieu, is so damaging, essentially, that a lot of the Singaporeans end up leaving in order to find a kind of inner peace. And so it's implied that Nick's father is one of these characters as well.
Hmm. Part of me wondered, I mean, there was a little backlash for casting Henry Golding as the lead romantic interest
Mm-hmm. There because, sure was.
Because he's half white, like me. And so that was very interesting because I get it, but also, will we ever fit in anywhere? No. And I think, honestly, it comes down to like how you present. And to me, Henry Golding presents as Asian, like whereas Keanu Reeves, for example, who's of mixed race, definitely passes as white. So I think it's different. I don't know.
That's interesting. Well, because with the father being off screen.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly. Exactly. It's implied that he's ethnically Chinese.
Yes.
But he's never actually physically on screen.
I'm not sure why there was backlash. Maybe we could talk about that for a bit. Are we not Asian?
This might be a bigger question than one podcast can handle.
Man.
Sorry. That was just my feeling. I get it. Like, yeah, I would love to see like a purely Asian man be able to lead a film. And I think we will get there. And I think we are getting there this year.
We're getting there this week with Searching.
Yes.
Starring John Cho.
Perfect. Exactly. So I don't really understand what the problem was. If he presents as, you know, Chinese or Singaporean, I think it's enough that we are having this film with an entirely Asian cast to carry that. You know, he's not just like the one token white dude.
There were no token white people.
There were token white people.
Were there?
The Miss Countries on the barge. They were just like props.
Oh,
so good.
I don't even know that I counted them as tokens. That's the token white person on this podcast. I don't know that I even counted them as tokens as much as like glorified extras.
Right.
But that's, it's so pivotal because like that's usually the Asian role. Does that make sense?
As sort of like a background
character? Yeah, yeah. We're usually like the throwaway characters. And to see like white people being used that way was, it gave me a chill.
I'm glad that it thrilled you in such a way. Yeah, there was no, which is a really good thing that they did not shoehorn in a white character because when they were initially developing this novel as a movie, there was talk that they would cast a white American actress as Rachel, which would have completely undermined the message of the movie. Certainly its ending, because the whole movie is about the dynamic between an Asian woman and an Asian American woman. And
yeah,
obviously that would not have happened.
I don't know how that would have flown at all.
Yeah.
Also, that would have been a completely different argument. Does that make sense?
Right, because yeah. Rachel sort of has, you know, she has this relationship with her mom, who is an immigrant and mm-hmm. who's Chinese, and she sort of finds the balance in the end.
So there are multiple other possible heirs to Nick's grandmother's fortune. So there's like a really cheesy Hong Kong film financier who mm-hmm. is in love with this soap opera actress named Kitty Pong, who is hilarious and about as, you know, serious as her name suggests. There is a...
They're like a power Ronnie couple.
Douchebag. Yes.
Ronnie Chang.
Power couple.
Yeah.
Ronnie Chang, I think, also happens to be like the only technically like Singaporean American person in the cast. And then there is Astrid, who is Nick's cousin and basically the person in the large clan that it's sort of like the only person that like they're really able to trust, that Nick and Rachel are really able to trust. And she has married a quote unquote commoner. And so that marriage is sort of supposed to be this like mirror image of Nick and Rachel's relationship, but it's actually extremely unhappy because her husband, the commoner, who is actually like a big tech startup guy.
And or wants to be.
Yeah.
Yes. He actually is full of resentment against her family's wealth. And so there's sort of like a cautionary of like how all of this could go wrong.
Astrid gets a really great introduction where we hear a voiceover about what she's like as a person, that she's kind of glamorous, but also warm-hearted. And we see her go into a jewelry store And she walks through and she stops to talk to a child, which is how we know she's warm-hearted. This movie is not subtle about these things in the best possible way. And then she goes and she buys an inordinately expensive piece of jewelry.
$2 million.
$2 million. Was it $2 million?
For earrings.
I think it's 1.2.
Oh, it was a discount.
right. Because he's like, well, if you wear them, that's like a huge publicity thing for
right,
me.
He'll sell it at cost for the low price of apparently 1.2 billion. Regardless of the cost, though, there is this funny scene where at least it seems funny on the surface, scene where she gets home and she hands all of her bags
over.
Well,
first she asks, is he home?
Oh, yeah, right.
And when they're like, he's home, she's like, you know what to do.
The staff take all of her purchases and stash them all over the house, culminating in her taking the earrings and putting them on top of her dresser, which we learn is, you know, it's not like in the funny way of like, oh, women be shopping, like, gotta hide it from my husband. He's deeply insecure about her wealth and the disparity between their backgrounds. One other thing I actually liked about their scene, and I liked about this movie in general, is that it doesn't, it's not precious about expository dialogue. So, like, there's a scene where they're in bed and she's like, you're not a Navy captain anymore. And I was like, great, established background.
Yes.
I mean, even earlier when the Rachel and Nick are in the bar and Nick's like, so, you know, it's my best friend's wedding coming up. I was like, out of the way. Love it.
Again, subtleties.
Very, very not, direct dialogue.
Yeah, subtleties were not part of this film.
Which, I mean, so, that's not what I'm looking for in a rom-com.
Not at all. And paired with the opulence, like, it was just, you know, a big smack in the face.
In a good mallet way. Of a movie.
Yes.
So one of my favorite scenes, actually, before they leave for Singapore, is between Rachel and her mom, who are mm-hmm. shopping mm-hmm. in some, like, cute little hipster boutique in, like, I don't know, the East Village or something. And Rachel clearly wanted help from her mom in finding a dress that would be appropriate to wear to meet Nick's family. And her mom says, wear a red dress because it symbolizes good fortune and fertility. And they sort of like make fun of this a little bit, but then she ends up wearing a red dress. And so I guess she's going to wear the same red dress that she for when she goes to meet Peaklin in the day and then intends to at night at Nick's grandmother's party. And we'll come back to the dress, but essentially they go to just this like, they go to Peaklin's house and Peaklin lives with her parents and her little sisters. Peaklin is played by Awkwafina. Her dad is played by Ken Jeong. And they are both extremely delightfully gaudy in a way that made me so happy. I think partly because a lot of Asian American identity revolves a lot around respectability, especially if we're talking about like the minority myth or whatever of like high achievement and our contributions to the economy or whatever. And you here you just have these like Asians hanging out, doing their own thing, being like as disgustingly tacky as they want to be and just reveling in it. And I love it.
Ken Jeong has a great intro too, where he at first pretends that he doesn't speak English well.
Oh my God.
And approaches Rachel. And then he laughs and he's like, I'm messing with you.
Yeah. And here like you Ken are Jeong. Like, oh, here is that fake Asian accent.
Right.
We are all like so scared of. And he's lying. It was good. And he also calls his daughter the Asian Ellen, which got a lot of laughs in my theater.
That wig is really something.
That wig was out of this world. Peaklin and Rachel are reunited and they catch up for a bit. And there's this scene where they're eating, I believe, lunch with her entire family. And I think they ask what she is up to after. And she mentions that she's going to a party at the Young's estate. And I think it dawns on their family that she's talking about the Young's. And it's at that moment where Rachel understands that she's basically dating Singaporean royalty. to which the dress comes into play.
It simply will not do.
It simply will not do.
This movie, in true rom-com fashion, I mean, it hit a lot of the classic moments, but the makeovers were especially satisfying for me. Mm. And the dress that Peeklin puts her in is gorgeous. In fact, I like this makeover a lot more than the second one, which we'll get to later. But so Peeklin makes her over, and then Peeklin offers to drive Rachel to the party because who would not want to?
So they're in Peeklin's like bubblegum pink Audi, which was like already like a really great start to the scene. Mm-hmm. And then they head into the woods, essentially like the tropical forest that like Singapore was before it got developed. And the GPS starts telling them, turn around, turn around, turn around.
There's nothing here.
Yes. Which, like, I guess, like, the implication is that it's sort of like Dick Cheney's compound and that, like, they're so powerful, they can, like, tell Google or whatever GPS company to, like, basically, like, drive people away from the young compound.
Yeah, so they think they're lost, and then suddenly two guards, one guard appears in the window, and there's kind of, like, a jump scare for babies like me.
Right there with you.
And it's kind of comical. And then a second guard pops up and then like they let them through the gate. And
I do think it's worth noting that the scene where the Sikh guards who are in these very white uniforms and red turbans, they're sort of these like quasi scary guards who come over and scare Rachel and Peeklin in the car. And it is actually, it was for me at least, like a slightly uncomfortable moment because the diversity of Singapore isn't quite here. Singapore is quite ethnically and religiously diverse. I think there are actually four official languages in Singapore. It's like Mandarin, English, Tamil, and Malay. And so we don't really get like a big display of the diversity of Singapore, which like in my mind is sort of like okay, because it's not really a movie about the like
it's called Singaporean
life as is.
Yeah. Yeah, we're looking at the 1% of Singapore.
No, right. We're looking at like the 0.01%. But I do think that like these are sort of the only dark-skinned Singaporeans that we see in the film. And it was, like, a little disappointing to me that they are essentially wordless and sort of, like, played for laughs. And that sort of made me uncomfortable. I think if there had been greater representation of darker-skinned or non-Chinese Singaporeans in the rest of the movie, like, that would have been okay. But I felt like we could have done better in that scene. I don't know who we is, but we could have.
No, I feel the same way. Because I think this movie, so much hope was placed on this movie in terms of Asian representation, and it was Eastern Asian representation. I think we definitely could have, it's true, we do use we. I think we could have fit in more diversity, it's true. At the same time, I don't know if, like, this movie aimed to do so many things. I don't know if that would have been one too many.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I know that, like, there's an Indian Singaporean character in the book who was like erased from Colin's bachelor party. I think it's like little things here and there. As much as I definitely celebrate this movie, I don't want to let moments like that go without
notice.
Without notice.
When they pull up to the front yard, there's like plenty of guests. It's obviously a very, very fancy event. People are dressed to, you know, the nines. And you can tell that Rachel is really freaked out. But I believe her boyfriend is there to to pick her up, right? Like to open the door for her.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So she gets out of the car, and because he is a polite man, he leans in through the window and looks at Pecklin and is just like, do you want to come in? So I think this movie was so great because if you are Asian, I think there is a lot that is unexplained that is just kind of intrinsic to this movie.
Like refusing the invitation out of politeness.
She did it like three times, which is kind of like, at least in my family, the unwritten rule is like you have to say no three times before you can accept. And it's really funny because it's kind of fake, but also you kind of really want to say yes, but you still have to say no. And I don't know, there's something really amazing about seeing it done in such a funny way,
mm-hmm.
because it's very much not just comedy.
Right.
There's also, yeah, I think that was like a good example of in Asian custom that like is observed. And so you get that cultural authenticity
mm-hmm.
of Awkwafina's character sort of declining that invitation because it's essentially this giant gift to her and maybe even to her family to have like, you know, someone in her like extremely tacky, lovably tacky nouveau riche family invited to like essentially the richest wasps of Singapore. So you have like the cultural authenticity of it. But on the other hand, you also have someone who is really subversive and full of pep, for lack of a better word, being able to turn that like say no three times first into like this really hilarious moment. And so it's both very like respectful of tradition, but also like subverting tradition at the same time. And I think like that is essentially like the magic formula for this movie. Mm-hmm. And that's just like this like tiny encapsulation of it.
Yeah, you put it really excellently. It's that it's the perfect marriage of like comedy at the same time respecting like actual Asian customs.
Okay,
so
should we mention that Pecklin has emergency outfits in the trunk of her car?
Oh my gosh,
with hilarious cocktail labels on them. Cocktail is the one that she winds up going with, but there's one for clubbing.
Yep,
and one for walk of shame.
Yes.
Which doesn't make sense because it's in the trunk of her car, but maybe she just has like a drive of shame outfit, which like if I were her, God bless. She's in like pajamas for most of the movie. I would be too if I were that rich.
Yeah. And that's what I really loved is like she's in designer pajamas. You know, the money is there. The style is not quite, but her styling of Rachel is always on point, which I thought was interesting.
I mean, I think she dresses like that deliberately. I don't think it's lack of style. I think that's,
yeah, that's
her signature
style.
Look.
Just the
much like the Asian Ellen haircut. It's just how she is.
So good.
Rachel is a mess.
Rachel's just uncultured.
A nervous wreck.
Rachel is the heroine in a romantic comedy.
And she spills such, wine.
She tries to wine. Drink. She tries to drink the washing water.
That's such a classic, like, I don't know how to be a rich person thing to do.
Absolutely.
Although I will say that I recently was served a bowl of mussels and like a little plate of water. And I was like, what do I do with a plate of water? I don't know. It was for my hands, guys. I did not try to drink it, though, because I am not the heroine in a romantic comedy. But I was instilled with panic. And so when I saw that scene, I was like, same girl. I don't know what to do.
I think that is one of the reasons Rachel is so endearing. And it shows why Nick may be attracted to her, because she's very different than what he grew up with. And I mean, we've all been there. Like, yeah, we were cringing in the movie theater when she tries to drink the bowl of washing water. And yeah, we definitely cringed when she spilled the wine all over his crisp shirt. But like, we've all been there. We've all done something a little faux pas-y.
She's also incredibly smart.
Yeah.
I mean, our first introduction to her is she's teaching game theory in front of a lecture hall full of students.
Mm-hmm.
And she trounces the student who is in front of her using psychology and strategy. So she's not just, you know, a nobody plucked off the street as much as Nick's family treats her that way. She's very smart. She's very accomplished.
That just made me realize, like, I think this movie is about choice, because you can be born into money and you can be a jerk like Astrid's husband who cheats on her. But ultimately, like, you get to choose if you're what, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
just because you weren't born into it doesn't mean you can't be smart or cultured, or you get to choose. Even like the Peak Lin's family, like they get to choose how they present as rich. Like they get to choose to not to be classy.
Yeah.
And Nick gets to choose between Rachel and his family. And Rachel also gets to choose not to let that happen.
So among the things that we get from this party, we are also introduced to poor cousin Oliver, played by Nico Santos from Superstore, who I adore, even though he has a terrible British accent in this.
It's really bad.
It's pretty bad. Wait, why did you say poor Oliver?
Because he's literally the poorer. Poor one,
wait, is he?
Relatively.
Well, he's not poor by most people's standards, but it is suggested that he's a...
He has to actually work for his money, unlike everyone else.
Gotcha.
And he does favors for the aunties.
That yes. we did notice, yes. When she's like, get rid of her to Kitty Pong.
All right, so at this party, Rachel makes a lot of faux pas. She mistakes Nick's old nanny for his grandmother, which is cringeworthy. She spills wine.
She meets Nick's mom.
In the kitchen.
They have a little verbal sparring match.
Mm-hmm.
And she meets Nick's grandmother, who it appears is a very nice lady and loves Rachel. Maybe.
Maybe.
She's definitely friendlier, I mean, in comparison. And it's interesting because you have Eleanor, Nick's mom, sort of hovering on the edge of that encounter. And you're kind of wondering, you can't really place where Nick's grandmother is going to be.
Yeah, and I kind of feel like Eleanor is panicking a little when she notices that Amma likes Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a wee bit jealous because she's never had that kind of easy acceptance from her mother-in-law.
Yes, and we learn later on that Eleanor herself wasn't considered to be from the right family and therefore was always considered to be the wrong woman to marry. Into Nick's family or into the Young family. And that's one of the reasons why she thought she had to sort of sacrifice Nick to his grandmother so that, like, Nick would live with his grandmother in order to have a greater chance at inheriting the family wealth. Which, like, if you think about it, is, like, quite devious, but... In her mind, she did it for her son's sake.
Yeah, which I think she says, right?
Yeah.
You have no idea what I've given up,
mm-hmm.
or something like that.
She's very
And then dynasty
dutiful.
Talk.
Right, yes. There was lots of dynasty talk. So Rachel does have some supporters among the upper class. One of them is Araminta, who, another classic rom-com moment, asks Rachel to join her bachelorette party. Even though they've just met, this is a thing. This is like very like my best friend's wedding, asking someone you barely know to be involved in wedding festivities. I mean, her bachelorette party is huge, so it's not quite that intimate, but it's like a nice moment of her supporting Rachel.
So Araminta's mother owns a chain of resorts. So basically they just go crazy at one of the resorts, which looks like it. It's like on a private island or something. The water is bluer than blue, and there's a masseuse for every single girl at the party. There's maybe about 10 of them. And so when they arrive, Araminta says something along the lines of, like, this is about sisterhood, and we're really going to dive deep into, like, our relationships and our bonds with each other. And then, of course, there's a shopping spree.
And we should mention that among the bachelorette party is Amanda, who is, you can just tell she's got like a villainous aura, but she is
I didn't
kind of,
think so.
You didn't think so?
No,
we didn't see that
I was
one
like,
coming.
Oh, a friend. They have common ground.
I was also, yeah, I was like, oh, good, like a sane person, because it's revealed
a
that
commoner.
Amanda is a lawyer for the young family's companies or something. And so you think that there is this kind of analogy to Rachel in this world, someone who is really accomplished on her own,
mm-hmm.
and is really professional and very skeptical toward this kind of like hyper-consumerism. They're, Rachel and Amanda are the only two who, like, mostly sit out the shopping spree, for instance.
Amanda, though, by her own admission, got the job because of nepotism.
Which,
I mean, maybe she's being self-deprecating, but...
Yeah, but that's what leads you to trust her. Is because she's hyper aware of this hyper consumerism, and that this lifestyle is probably ridiculous to someone like Rachel, because they both come from the same roots. You know, immediately she kind of like aligned herself with Rachel.
That's why I didn't trust her. Rom com rules, baby. The ex girlfriend is always trouble. This ain't no Legally Blonde, okay?
Honestly, so, I thought there might have been like a little queer moment there. Like my heart skipped a beat, where she puts the necklace around Rachel's neck.
Oh, there was a little bit of
like
a homoerotic tension.
Oh, yeah, I was.
But
there
I definitely took that as a sinister moment. I was right, by the way.
You were.
That's
you
the
were.
Point. Is
you can never trust anyone who puts a gold necklace around the heroine. Like it's just always a sign,
and then says perfect.
So in the next scene, Amanda eats Rachel. Just kidding. Sorry.
Wait,
like Marissa and I just looked at each other like,
so
what did we see?
So
amazing.
All of the women are having massages in the same outdoor area. And Amanda sort of casually lets it drop that the Young family and her family had always wanted her and Nick to get married because, of course, she's from the right
stock
family. Yes, from the right stock. And basically implies to Rachel that if she marries Nick, her life will be nonstop suffering.
Yeah, trying to prove that she's worthy.
And so Rachel understandably gets upset, leaves the massage area, goes to her room, and discovers a gutted fish on her bed. And the words, I don't know, something along the lines of like, get out, you gold digger, is written in blood on the window panes from the gutted fish. And by that time, Astrid has arrived, also sees the gutted fish. And Astrid says, I'll call the police for you or security. And Rachel decides, like, no, I don't want to make a scene. Like, I want to fight back. So I guess later that night when it gets dark and all of the bachelorette girls are just kind of like dancing around, Rachel and Astrid get to dig a hole to put the fish in.
Yeah, and I think it was a really important scene because Rachel chooses to not make a scene about the fish.
Can I ask a silly question? Why
yes.
did they bury the fish instead of throwing it in the ocean?
Because digging holes creates bonds and camaraderie.
That's
fair enough.
Sopranos.
That's what we learned from the war.
Well, listen, this was no horse head in the bed. They could have just thrown the fish into the ocean. Anyway, just pointing that out.
It would have washed up back on the beach, probably.
It's a fish.
It's a bachelorette party. We cannot have dead fish on the beach.
All right. So it does create this opportunity for the two of them to bond and for Astrid to confess that her husband is cheating on her, which she found out in the most horrible way by reading a text message.
The bed is lonely without you or something like that. Cringe.
All right. So that's what's going on with the women. Shasha, how are the men spending their bachelorette party?
So Bernard tells Nick that he has a crazy bachelor party planned for him, for Colin. And it gets weird. Don't they get in a helicopter?
They do.
And they get
into a fleet of helicopters.
Right. They get into a fleet of helicopters. Bernard wants Colin to know that he did it all for Colin. And as he's saying this, you see that they're flying into international waters. So you know something is about to go down.
You don't just see this. It It's like in giant lettering on the screen, much like all of the locations in this movie.
Yeah.
And most of them are like Singapore or like New York. And this one is international waters.
Exactly.
Can I just say, I also, you know from the very beginning that Bernard, like there's something a little off about him because he wears yellow sunglasses the entire time. And there is just like no way not to look like a douche when you're wearing yellow sunglasses.
Noted.
Yeah, and he wears a lot of.
I'm going to take my yellow sunglasses off sheepishly right now.
Yeah, something about his fashion choices makes you understand that he's the black sheep. And a little bit crazy.
Very frequently shirtless, and not like the good kind of shirtless, but like the bad kind of shirtless.
That was so cryptic that I'm afraid to ask. You mean, he's not just shirtless. He's got like an open.
Yeah, like a blazer.
Yeah.
Like a smoking jacket. Velvet smoking jacket.
Yeah, he and Pickling could
kick it. They could definitely kick it.
They could have their own fashion line, which I would definitely wear.
Anyway, so they're in this fleet of helicopters flying into international waters. And they look over at the horizon and there is a gigantic barge, like the kind of barge that's used to transport, what are they called? Containers, mm-hmm. When people are moving overseas. And they land on this barge and it is essentially a gigantic man playground, complete with bazookas. Miss America, Miss Columbia is there. What else is there?
There's I was not reading misses. The sashes.
I was reading the sashes. I was like, show me these women.
And there's a scene where all of the men that like we've met so far get together. And there's like another character who comes in and says something like, Eddie is also there. Eddie is sort of like this like finance guy who's obviously a jerk because finance. And so he tells Nick, I can't believe you're not getting more shit for wanting to marry Rachel when, like, my wife is, like, from the family fortune of, like, the biggest shipping company in Hong Kong, and I got shit. And people are just sort of letting you do whatever you want. And so they're both – and so, like, all of the men are kind of like, what is Rachel actually bringing to the table?
Right.
So – we right. get like a better sense of like how the opposition to the marriage from the Singaporean side between Nick and Rachel is not just about Nick's mom and her like weird eccentricities or idiosyncrasies. It's actually like this whole society that just like doesn't really understand why you would marry someone if they weren't bringing like a gajillion dollars to the table.
And later we find out this is not actually a superficial concern, even though it's largely coming from superficial characters, because Nick and Colin realize that this is not their scene and they have their own little getaway, sort of a bachelor party within a bachelor party.
They land the helicopter on a rock.
You know, they're very talented. This is another reason I keep going back to 50 Shades. This sort of like these bizarre parallels of like the hero who can fly a helicopter in hilarious circumstances. But they sit, the two of them. And shirtless and have
drinking
this,
a beer.
The good shirtless.
The good shirtless. Kind of shirtless. And Colin gets real with Nick and says, you know, that he's bringing someone into the family who may not be able to deal with the kind of unreasonable pressures that coming with being one of the Youngs. And we see Nick sort of for the first time seriously grappling with what it would mean.
Yeah, and they also talk about what Rachel wants. Mm-hmm. Rachel loves her job at NYU. She loves teaching, and the expectation is that Nick will take over his family's company, and she would be expected, if they get married, to move to Singapore. And what would that look like for Rachel? What would she do?
And Ingu, what is Nick's reaction to this little conversation?
Isn't he mostly just like, oh
yeah, he's like, I didn't think of that.
I meant when he proposes.
Oh shit!
I didn't mean like. Sorry, that's on me.
Oh
not
no,
clear.
We both had the same reaction. I was like, herder. I don't know.
Abs,
pecs. Look at my smile.
Now that we're done objectifying poor Henry Golding,
we should note here though that like, We know that Nick is serious about Rachel because he shows his buddy the diamond ring that he plans to propose with. And it's a very beautiful but very generic ring that's studded with diamonds. And you're sort of like, oh, like pretty, but also like, oh, that's it. And like that will play into this later.
Josh's eyes just widened.
It was a nice ring.
I thought so too.
I mean yeah, yes, nice for ring. Them, but for us, it was a nice ring. For them, it was probably like brass, you know, like.
I thought it was aligned with Rachel's, it was more her style than something that.
Yeah, gaudy. And
one of the rest of the family would wear.
So after they get back from their debauchery, Nick and Rachel return to his grandmother's house where they make where a lot of the family members get together. Maybe there's around 10 people at the table and they talk about keeping traditions alive, and they symbolize this through the making of dumplings together. And we learn a little bit more about Nick and Astrid's childhoods and how they were cared for by their mothers who had to uphold these really grandiloquent households and yet at the same time provide like an extremely sheltered domestic life. And so Nick, for example, would get homemade dumplings made by his mother after school. So they're sitting around the table making these dumplings, and Rachel asks Eleanor, how did she and her husband meet, and where did this giant emerald necklace that she's wearing come from? And so we learn that Eleanor and her husband met while they were in Cambridge. Eleanor was studying to be a lawyer, and after she got married, she drops out and devotes her whole life to caring for her family.
And here we really see sort of the softer side, not the softer side even, but sort of the noble side of Eleanor. And it clicks, at least it clicked for me, why she is the way that she is and why she's treating Rachel the way that she does. Not to say that it's acceptable, but it certainly humanized her and made it much more understanding, especially since we see Amma is not super nice to her.
Yeah, this scene, you really see Rachel trying to ingratiate herself with Eleanor. She is trying to pay her a compliment, and instead, Eleanor's like, you have no idea what this ring cost me. Well, because her husband made the ring expressly for her, because Amma would not give her son the family ring, because did not approve of the marriage. Mm-hmm. And you also see this vicious cycle between Eleanor and Rachel, where just because Eleanor suffered, I think in some ways she is making Rachel suffer a little bit too.
Which honestly, I don't know about anyone else's background, but that
I know
is
exactly
like
what you're about to say.
Every single Korean soap opera storyline ever.
It is so true. It is. It's like it's the basis of like the matriarchal like. State of families is like, if you do not have your mother-in-law's approval, you will never make it.
There was one thing about the dumpling scene I also wanted to mention. Oh, so one of the biggest themes of the movie is about how Rachel wants to pursue happiness and her passions. And Eleanor is very skeptical of this and essentially says something along the lines of like, those are really fleeting. What we are trying to do here is build something that lasts. And so there's a scene where there's a famous scene, I guess now by this point, where Rachel heads toward the bathroom and is ascending a staircase, and Eleanor walks after her and stops her at the staircase landing. And then more or less puts Rachel down in like a very like unsubtle way, where Rachel has to like go back down the stairs a little bit so that she is looking up at Eleanor, and Eleanor says, "You will never be enough."
Devastating.
At which point At which point we know that this rom-com stakes are not really about Rachel and Nick getting together, because Nick is head over heels in love with Rachel. The stakes of this romantic comedy is Rachel proving herself worthy to Eleanor.
So
Eleanor tells her that she'll never be enough. And Rachel, because she's our hero, bounces back and is like, I'm not going to go down like that. And what's his name?
Oliver.
Oliver and Peaklin make her hot.
Such a good makeover montage, but such an unsatisfying result. At least I felt that way. I think, Ingu, you felt the same way, right?
I really hate that blue dress that you're seeing in all of the advertisements.
I quite liked it.
It's very Cinderella.
I thought it was very in line with exactly what she was trying to do, which was to look like she fit into that world.
Mm.
Because the dress from before was casual enough. I mean, it was an expensive
dress.
Yeah, like the stripy one. It was expensive, but also like casual enough for, like, you could see someone walk down the street in that and you'd be like, that's a nice dress. This was like an opulent dress you could only ever wear to a wedding of Singaporean royalty.
And what a wedding it was.
And what a wedding it was. oh, my God. I was with a friend who said, and we can get to this later, but I was with a friend who said, you know you're rich when your wedding dress gets wet on purpose.
Yes. So much.
Yeah.
That wedding was really incredible. That was an amazing set piece.
It was. Like, the mix of, like, jungle, like, with the birds of paradise everywhere, and how the guests were all holding pieces of, like, branches with LED lights in them to make them kind of look like bugs or lightning bugs. It was super magical. And then the water just, like, flows up.
The bride literally walking on water.
Literally. She's not even wearing shoes.
I know.
Because she's a ballerina in real life, I believe.
Oh, really?
And you really see that come out in the way that she walks down that aisle with her foot first. No shoe. Wearing, like, some, like, gorgeous, like, silky stocking.
Mm-hmm.
Covered in glitter.
Glitter all over her.
Yes,
legs.
Definitely glitter. Lots of glitter. But the most important part is, like, who cares about what's happening in the marriage? It's that Rachel and Nick cannot keep their eyes off of each other.
Well, Rachel has asserted herself not just by looking hot, but she also makes a very important seating decision.
Next to the princess.
Yes, she's not welcome to sit with Nick's family. And so she brushes that off and she goes and sits next to the princess. And she's read an article that she wrote. I wasn't super clear on
about microloans.
Right. And they start talking and it sort of catches everyone's notice, including Nick's family.
Well, because this princess has reserved an entire row for herself because she does not want to talk to anybody. So at first, when you see Rachel walk up to her, you're like, don't do it. Don't do it. But then it turns out really well.
Be the water all over again. Don't drink the water.
Don't drink the water. Don't spill the wine. And they're actually sitting in front of Nick's family at that point. And you just see the look on Eleanor's face, like the outrage.
And then on Nick's face, when he realizes
pride,
that
so much pride,
she can hold her own.
Mm. That was such a good scene. And then they just can't take their eyes off each other. The bride is walking down the aisle, and all that matters is that Nick and Rachel are looking into each other's eyes, and they're like mouthing, I love you.
So they have the reception at the Gardens by the Bay, which is basically Singapore's most famous
landmark.
Sightseeing landmark, where you have these, like, beautiful lit, I think they're called, like, super plants or something. But anyway, they have this, like, very extravagant reception, and it seems to be a really great time. And Rachel gets called over by Eleanor and Nick's grandmother. And she isn't really sure what this is all about, but essentially Rachel and Nick go over and she essentially gets ambushed at this wedding because Eleanor has hired a private investigator to look into Rachel's past and discovers that Rachel has quote unquote lied about her family background. So up until this point, Rachel believes that her father died before she was born, and now she discovers that her father actually is alive, lives in China, and her mother had lied to her about her origins. And so Rachel is devastated by of course, Eleanor doing this, and by Nick's grandmother also deciding that Rachel is not good enough to join the family.
And by the knowledge that her father is alive also.
And that her mother lied to her as
right.
well.
So she runs away from the wedding. And this is like, I think, maybe the only time in the movie where you get a sense of how revolting all of this wealth can look to someone who is just trying to escape it all.
Mm. Yeah, you're talking about the montage scene where they actually shot it in a way that I think is expressly meant to be grotesque.
Right. As she's running away.
Yeah, it's like very Fellini-esque. Yeah. I think Araminta at one point is like screaming while eating a cake, like cackling like a witch. Like it's shot with the camera on her body, so you have everything like from her perspective. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like done like a drunk like sequence in some shows.
Yeah, it's like a weird like slow-mo that mm-hmm. really highlights the excesses of all of this wealth, of which obviously the private investigation is one of them.
Real quick before we end this, we need to do Astrid justice.
Yes.
I don't remember what makes Astrid like break at that point, but
it's because Michael was planning on missing his son's birthday party.
Oh, good one. Yes. And at one point, Astrid brings up their son's birthday party, which Michael says he's just not going to be able to make it because he has a business trip or whatever, or he's going to go see his girlfriend, something like that. And Astrid puts her foot down and tells him that she's not leaving. He's going to leave. Right? It's her apartment. Mm-hmm. It's her wealth. And she's going to do whatever she damn pleases with it. And that she doesn't want to have to hide anymore the fact that like she comes from money. And that because she doesn't want to threaten his manhood anymore. And she delivers a very, very cutting monologue about how she can't make him a man because she can't. Ooh. Yeah, it's just so bad. She can't make him the man that he's not.
And then, crucially, she retrieves the earrings that have been sitting all 1.2 million a steel on top of her bureau. And it's such a powerful moment.
And because the story behind the earrings is that there was a female royal who had essentially self-coronated herself. And that was like the earrings that she wore at the ceremony.
Oh, that's a great little tidbit. Did the jeweler mention that in the very beginning?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I saw the movie twice. This is how I know everything. Otherwise, I don't think I would have caught it either.
I need to see it again. But yeah, that's essentially it for Astrid, right?
Yep.
So basically, Rachel runs off to Peaglin's house, and Peaglin is trying to comfort her and just sort of leaves her alone, which is what Rachel wants.
Her family pitches in too, which is very sweet.
Yes.
I can't believe we haven't mentioned the creepy brother, but
now is as good a time as any. Peaglin's brother is super creepy.
What's his name? He's just creepy brother.
I don't know. I was hyper-focused on his creepiness. What a great family. But it was also, I think this was an important moment for them as a family because they are so tacky and over the top and obsessed with matching the wealth of the old money. And yet when Rachel is in need, they are all there for her, creepy brother included, which is nice. And it's a really sweet moment where the whole family has her back.
Yes, and so Peaglin comes in at some point while Rachel has been in bed for 3 days or something and says, there's someone here to see you. And Rachel says, I don't want to see Nick. And then, surprise, it's actually her mother. And so they have this really gorgeous heart-to-heart about Rachel's past and why her mother lied. And so what we learn is that essentially, Rachel's father was physically abusive, and Rachel's mom had an affair with a different man, got pregnant by that other man, and then ran away to America because she was afraid that her husband would kill her. And so she never contacted the other man again because she feared that any sort of contact might lead her husband back to her. And so you have this sort of like island of two, which I found like surprisingly moving, actually. And that whole scene between Rachel and her mom is also very moving. But it is sort of like exactly the nourishing care that Rachel needs to stand up once more to Eleanor. And so the next time that we see her, we see Eleanor walking very deliberately into this mahjong parlor, which seems a little bit like beneath her. She's in this like very crisp white striped suit.
I think it was Chanel, actually.
The power suit.
I believe it. What else would Eleanor wear?
Exactly.
It's not yellow sunglasses, that's for sure.
And so she sits down at a mahjong table, and there is Rachel across from her.
Yes, and she sits down in the east seat, which means she's the dealer.
Damn, Sasha.
This scene is amazing.
Okay, so I've played mahjong once, but I did not know what I was doing, and someone was helping me. And so this scene, to me, I did not necessarily know what was going on, but it was so choreographed and the psychology was so clear that I felt you didn't need to know the rules of mahjong to understand exactly what was going on. It was a battle of wits being played both verbally and with the tiles.
So I think the thing that people didn't realize is like she does not win this game.
I noticed that.
Okay.
I thought that was clear. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, because when she puts down her tiles, it kind of seems like she won. And she did win.
She won the argument.
She won the argument. Oh, sorry, Rachel. When at the very end where, you know, like they're doing that quick montage where the tiles are moving, they're mixing, and then she just like puts down her tiles. It seems like she wins the game, but she deliberately loses. She deliberately gives up her hand, which is exactly what she's doing in the scene when she sits down with Eleanor. And Eleanor and her have this conversation about, again, the differences between American Chinese and Chinese culture, I think. The difference between building something long-lasting, like a dynasty, as opposed to pursuing your passion and the freedom to dream. And at that point, Rachel drops the bomb that Nick has already proposed to her, Eleanor is completely shocked. You can tell, like, it kind of throws her off.
And she seems bracing for Rachel to gloat.
Exactly. But instead, Rachel tells her that she said no, because in any case, I believe in any case, both of them would, it was a lose-lose situation where she could have Nick, but then Nick wouldn't have his family, or she would lose Nick to his family. And then she wouldn't have Nick anymore. And the worst choice was Nick not having his family.
She said to Eleanor, they're playing mahjong this whole time without their own, just glancing at the tiles and having this in-depth conversation with these other two women who are old and I guess can't hear them, which is very convenient. But Rachel tells Eleanor that she has turned down Nick and that when Nick does eventually marry
that's what it is.
Someone who Eleanor considers worthy, Eleanor should keep in mind that as she's playing with her grandchildren, that it's only possible because someone
a commoner immigrant
made it happen.
Yeah. And at that point, she shows her hand. So during the game, what happens is Eleanor shows her play and what she's trying to do is match tiles. And Rachel sees that, and I think that's at the point where Eleanor is telling her about, like, building something long-lasting. And so in some ways, Eleanor is showing her hand and how she's going to win. And Rachel, who is, you know, a proficient gambler herself, I think, because of the very beginning of the movie.
Game theory. Time for some game theory.
Exactly. She sees the kind of play that Eleanor is trying to make and starts to collect her own tiles. And at one point, she gets the tile that she knows that Eleanor needs to win. But she could also win with that tile. And she decidedly takes that tile, which is funny. It's the eight of bamboos, and eight is a very lucky number. And I don't know if they did that on purpose. She takes that tile and she discards it. And in Mahjong, that means that Eleanor could pick it up and complete her hand, basically. And that's exactly what happens. Eleanor does not realize that Rachel knows that she just gave up the one tile that would allow Eleanor to win. And so she triumphantly shows her hand, Eleanor shows her hand, being like, you know, I won, take it. And,
in her power suit,
in her power suit, just like with that smug look on her face. And it's at that point where Rachel makes that, says that, delivers that monologue about how, you know, in 20 years from now, when Nick is married to the right person and you're playing with your grandchildren in your fancy fucking mansion, just remember that it was all thanks to me. And she shows her hand, which shows that with that tile, she would have won, but she didn't. She decidedly chose not to win.
And then I think just as meaningfully, Rachel exits the table and essentially walks over to her mom, who had been there the whole time. And the two of them walk out. And then the mom, Rachel's mom, very meaningfully looks at Eleanor. And it is just a look of extreme death.
All right. So this takes us to the classic, like, not even rush to the airport, rush onto the airplane as Rachel and her mother are getting ready to go back to the U.S. And
this
Nick
scene
bursts onto the plane. And I know he's super wealthy, but I just this is like a classic rom-com moment where you're like, in real life, this could never happen.
No,
because of heavy security, first class or not.
Do you know who I am?
But he chases Rachel onto this plane, and he is hilariously dodging and weaving these tourists and various others who are trying to get their baggage put away and find their seats.
And it's so, like, very much a inverse of that airplane scene that we start the movie with.
Absolutely.
Where they're in, like, first class. And this time, instead of Rachel meeting Nick where he is, it's Nick meeting Rachel where she is, because she has a line at the beginning of the movie about being coach people. And so as she's trying to get to her seat with her mom, Nick runs over and is like very chivalrously helping various people put their luggage up into the luggage space.
But also, and like stepping over people.
He's trying his best.
He is. This scene made me cringe. It's like, okay, Nick is not important. The real story here is about the women. But anyway.
That's the question. Like, is this movie about the relationship between Rachel and Eleanor? Or is it about Rachel and Nick? I think it can be both. I love this proposal. If only because, yes, it's very funny that he's, you know, helping people with their luggage as he's clearly building to propose and everyone is oblivious. But I also really love that when he finally does propose, and we'll talk about the actual mechanism of the proposal, but the other passengers are like, yes, girl!
Especially the woman right behind.
So good. She's, and like, Rachel's mom is there.
Yeah.
But when he does propose, he opens the box, and what does the ring look like?
It's the emerald ring from his mom. Which means the whole family is behind their marriage at this point.
With the implication being that Eleanor is the reason that the whole family.
Rachel forced her hand.
Right. She had no other choice.
Rachel literally said, like, just remember that he'll resent you for this. Boom. Walk away, drop the mic.
What a great ending.
I thought the ending was a bit messy, where they said that let's not go home right now. Let's go back to this gigantic party that's being thrown for us so we can reunite everybody and, like, see the whole cast one last time.
Well, that's because we need a sequel.
Right.
That party wrapped things up, everyone in one place. It also led us to the most important mid-credit scene of all time. Ingu, what happens during the credits? I should say, by the way, I had a train to catch, so I left my screening as soon as the credits started to roll. And as I left the theater, I heard every woman
gasp
in the room scream. And I was like, what's going on out here? Why was everyone screaming at you?
So So we are at this party. This like essentially like an engagement party thrown for Nick and Rachel. Everybody is there. It's on top of the Marina Bay Sands, which if you know what that is, it's like basically the most famous building in all of Singapore. And they're like on the roof of it. And I guess we forgot to mention this, but like midway through the movie, we essentially see Astrid's husband, Michael, leave her. And so we see we see Astrid, and then we see her looking at a man who looks at her. He is played by Harry Shum Jr., which for a lot of, Asian Americans, I don't know, he's sort of just like the hunk.
He's our Prince Harry.
And so there's no dialogue. All you see is just the two of them looking at each other, which is obviously the sequel for Crazy Rich Asians 2.
And what a setup. Also, he's billed, Harry Shum Jr. is billed really high in the cast, considering he's literally in the movie for what, 10 seconds?
5 seconds.
5 seconds. Yeah. Just five.
It speaks to a level of movie stardom that bodes well for Crazy Rich Girlfriend, which I assume will be the sequel. Shasha, Ingu, will I see both of you back here for what I hope will be the inevitable sequel, China Rich Girlfriend?
Absolutely.
Yeah, Ingu, you in?
Sure, why not?
Thank you both.
I'm only a little hesitant because, at least in the books, it's all about Kitty Pong. And I feel like Kitty Pong is a spice that you put in small amounts and not like eat as the main course. So I'm very curious where it's going to go. But I'm here for Rachel.
Yes. And Astrid.
And Astrid.
Can't wait to see her with our Prince Harry.
Well, thank you both for spoiling Crazy Rich Asians with me. And thank you for listening. Please subscribe to the Slate Spoiler Special podcast feed. And if you like the show, rate and review it in the Apple Podcast Store or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have suggestions for movies or TV shows we should spoil, or if you have any other feedback you'd like to share, please send it to spoilers@slate.com. For Shasha and Ingu, I'm Marissa Martinelli. Our producer is Danielle Hewitt. Thanks for listening.